Welcome to a special episode of Movie Geeks United. Tonight, we are proud to feature our interview with acclaimed composer Christopher Young. Mr. Young is a composer of tremendous diversity. You can see it in some of the great films that he's composed scores for, including Runaway Jury, The Shipping News, Bandits, Spider-Man 3. But he's also earned the distinction of one of our most accomplished horror film composers. Who can forget his beautiful, haunting, and operatic themes for movies like Hellraiser or Drag Me to Hell? Mr. Young's new film is titled Sinister, and it opens in theaters on October 12th.
Jamie.
Hi, Mr. Young. How are you, sir?
I'm doing very well. And yourself?
I am very good. Let me tell you, we are such big fans of film score on this program, and you are one of our absolute favorites, so it's a great pleasure to speak with you.
Seriously? Oh, that sends shivers up and down my spine.
I've
my head to my toe and halfway up my ass. Okay.
That's exactly the effect I wanted it to have, yeah. I've lived with your scores for so long. I love them. Tell me about the latest project, Sinister. What kind of what was particularly exciting to you about your work in this one?
Well, I would have to say two things were particular. Well, three things. First of all, it gave me an opportunity to reconnect with the director, Scott Derrickson, who I hadn't worked with since a feature he'd done two features ago, which was called The Exorcism of Emily Rose.
Mm-hmm.
And he's an awesome fellow who's so incredibly talented and chock full loaded with some really sharp imaginative ideas about how music could enhance his picture. So it was good to get reconnected with him, number one. Number two was that the picture itself, is in horror films, often one of the, a plot line can be sacrificed in the name of trying to scare the living daylights out of the audience.
Right.
Here, you are scared, but it actually works in a manner that I find the best horror films have always and will always work in, and that is they tantalize you by offering up something that creates a state of horror within the mind,
Mm-hmm.
Is there blood and guts in this movie? Not really. You don't see any, violent murders happening on the screen. So it's not a gore fest. It's not one of those type of films. Rather, it's about a character who, starts unraveling pieces of a storyline, only to find out that he himself ultimately is the victim of the story that he's unraveling. So it's an enticing mystery of sorts, as well as a terrifying horror story. Now, finally, probably the most exciting for me was being given the opportunity to do something with a score that I'd never done before,
Mm-hmm.
And what might be what that is? What is that, you might wonder? Simply that whereas I have included electronics in a lot of my scores before, and have thought of the orchestra in an electronic manner, I've never had the opportunity to do an all-electronic score that's trying to sound electronic and not like a low-budget orchestra. So in terms of the sonorities, it was a new experience for me, And as a consequence, I think the score sounds different than anything I've done.
Well, a couple of questions come up from what you just said. First of all, it sounds like the film belongs in kind of the school of cerebral horror that I know that you prefer. I mean, that's
right.
Yeah,
that's right. It definitely fell in that school. It was H.P. Lovecraft who so wonderfully said, the oldest emotion known to mankind is fear. And the greatest fear of them all is that of the unknown. I'm sort of paraphrasing his words, but that was the concept.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing more terrifying in my book than a great ghost story. My favorite horror film, and I don't mean, it's not really a horror film, it's a haunted house film of all time, but you would find it in the horror section in the DVD store, is the original black and white Haunting. And I have a massive collection of classic ghost stories, short fiction stories, and novels, novellas that are dedicated to the genre, the fantasy genre, horror, sci-fi, whatever. But the ones that have always captured my interest the most are a great ghost story. It's being mentally challenged and tantalized and ultimately horrified by something which is in, which comes from that invisible world.
Well, you've done a lot of scores in the horror genre. I know you're a particular fan of that genre. And, I think of the operatic kind of Baroque nature of a Hellraiser or Drag Me to Hell. And then I think of a story like I think you're talking about, like your beautiful score for The Uninvited, that's another score that I have on repeat.
Oh, I'm so touched. That's a score which I kind of have forgotten. Hellraiser I can't forget because I'm reminded of it constantly. Drag Me to Hell, fortunately, of my more recent ones, seems to have been a score, surprisingly to me, that has connected with so many people. When I wrote it, I didn't know that film was going to be received as well as it has been, but that the score at the same time would come across as the perfect bed partner for it. For me, it was
absolutely,
like, I'm doing my best. I love Sam. I really dig this movie. And I'm just trying to make sure that whatever I deliver to him, to that movie, doesn't sound like a tired version of Hellraiser,
Right, right. Working in this genre, does it allow you to flex, to allow you a certain freedom to flex different muscles than other genres?
Well, certainly. Say what you will about horror films, they're sort of the idiot bastard son of the film industry.
Mm.
It's, they're going to be the talk of the town throughout the month of October, but come November, as we're approaching the Oscars, all of that wonderful energy and all of that excitement that was generated, most importantly, all the money that was generated by those movies, will be, conveniently forgotten, when it comes time to starting to talk about the Oscars. So they're a strange lot, those horror films are. We can't live without them. We claim we can, but at the end of the day, we can't. We need them, young and old seem to appreciate them. There's no age limit to their appeal, which is not surprising. But for a composer, of course, what they offer is the opportunity to first and foremost be aggressive. With my students at USC, when we're talking about how the best way to approach a horror score would be, first and foremost, I asked him a simple question. Do you love the genre or not? Have you ever loved the genre? Because if you don't, then you're kind of fooling yourself. Because, sure, you can write big, ugly, scary music. Pretty much anyone can do that. I mean, you put an infant in front of a piano, and what do? They don't sit and start playing some wonderful tonal piece. They're bashing on it with their fists, you know. Mm. There's something, you know, again, primitive and so appealing and so primal to the kind of aggressive music that horror films require. You know, I don't know if you ever had, you're a horror film fan. I don't know if you've ever seen a horror film without any music. It's different. I'm not going to say it doesn't work. I'm just going to simply say probably of all the different kinds of movies that are out there to be consumed, the ones that are in which you notice the absence of music the most is probably horror movies. There's so many directors that have turned to me and said in their own silent way, something's missing here, Chris. I don't know exactly what it is, but can your music help bring it back to what it was intended to be or what I saw it or imagined it to be when it was on paper? And that's the wonderful thing that I think horror scores can do. At the end of the day, they can be the key. And it's a subconscious thing. The audience is not being told in words, but just through sound, through pitches. They're being given the key to step into the image, to go behind the image, to enter this really deep, bottomless, sick pit of a world that the best of these kind of movies live in. Again, going back to H.P. Lovecraft, he said when he evaluates a great horror story, it may have a lousy plot line, and it may peter around absurdity. But just as long as there's some moment where things fall apart and the reader is truly strapped by the horror of a moment in the story, in terms of the language, and then I'll shut up. In terms of the language that it offers you, of course, it's if you're working with an orchestra, you get to work with a language that's more comparable to, you know, sort of 20th century modern orchestral music, concert music.
Yeah.
You know, I just happen to remember hearing the music of Penderecki, who was the Polish composer that was one of the handful of guys who really explored cluster music, sound mass music. Hearing it for the first time and going, my God, I think I've just heard the voice of God, you know. These kind of clusters, that doesn't scare me. You know, a lot of majority people will listen to this cluster music and go, oh, that's scary music. Who wants to hear that? I mean, come on, I can hear that in a movie. You don't expect me to listen to that on its own, do you? You know, I don't think Penderecki expected that the language that he was writing in was going to end up in Hollywood movies scaring people.
but it was used so beautifully in The Shining. I think Kubrick used some of his music. Yeah,
sure. Penderecki was used in The Shining. Ligeti was used in 2001. You know, these are the two biggest members of that group of what we call sound mass composers.
Yeah. But I think the horror genre it begs for a heightened experience. And when I think of kind of infamous stories of film scores, I think of back on Jaws, where they said when they saw it without music, it was okay. But when the music came on, it just brought it to another level. It sparked something in the subconscious that dread.
It's very, very true. And it's wonderful that everybody, even the people that worked on the movie, they know that they recently released the Blu-ray version of that movie. It so happened that I decided I'd always wanted to go to Martha's Vineyard, even one from the East Coast. And this summer they had the second of the Jaws festivals there on Martha's Vineyard, which is where they shot the movie. And, you know, if you look at the DVD, the Blu-ray, the new Blu-ray, it, when they're talking about the making of the movie, there's a couple of bonus features now on the Blu-ray. They all unanimously say the same thing. You know, every single person who ends up, who does bring up the music says, you know what? Without the music, this movie would have gone nowhere, you
mm-hmm.
know? Now,
mm-hmm.
I want to point something out to you about Jaws. You mentioned Jaws. Yes, it's so thoroughly enmeshed in the meaning of that movie. But yet, the music that the public at large remembers the most is that simple little half-step idea, you know?
Right.
When people think, you know, the half, the ascending half-step, boom, 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 boom. Okay. Simple as simple can be. You heard the story that when Spielberg showed up to Williams' house and said, so play me the Jaws theme, and he played that for him, Spielberg said, you've got to be kidding me. You're joking. Well, you know, he was expecting something entirely different.
Yeah.
And smartly, Williams knew that simplicity was the key to success.
Yeah.
You know, all you needed was something as simple as that, a half step. Now, mind you, go back to King Kong, you know, the first Hollywood movie that had a horror movie that had what was essentially a wall-to-wall score, you know, the first horror film that allowed the score to participate in the, you know, in such an aggressive way. The Kong motive is two half steps. Or was it one, one, two, three? Three notes, they're descending half steps. Yeah?
Mm.
So it's a formula, you know, simplicity is the key. Halloween, simple. Very simple. Psycho, the shower room scene. Shrieking strings, downward. A gesture. It's just a gesture.
Yeah.
Friday the 13th. It's just words put through delay. Ma, can't. You know?
Yeah.
Syllables through delay. In other words, horror scores can, at the crux of them, what you really need is a very, very simple idea.
Yeah.
A very, very simple idea can be the most effective idea to hold the whole thing together. Now, you can offset that or enhance it with monstrously large moments of orchestral madness. But really, if you have a simple idea, you're halfway there, you know, or three quarters of the way there.
Well, you were talking about your kind of move to electronics.
Yeah.
With this latest score, when I think of your scores, I mean, part of what I love so much about them is they're very full and very melodic sounding.
Right, sure.
But there's a trend going on now with the advent of electronics in movie scores where they're almost indiscernible from the sound effects at times.
Yeah, that's right.
Is that troubling to you? Do you feel like we're losing melody, and do you think that that's valuable?
You know what? I'm an old school guy. I'd be bullshitting you if I didn't say that I still believe that the best of scores have always been and will always be ones that are held together by one, two, three, four, maybe at the most five memorable melodies or motives, and sometimes even more than that, you know, melodies or motives. Or if not even motives, at least some sort of a sound bite, like the shower sequence,
mm-hmm.
like the Jaws motive. That's a sound bite. You know, that's a motive. That's a gel, a germ cell, or whatever, of a musical idea. The smallest subdivision and idea, but yet it's a reoccurring idea that holds it together. When I look at my scores for horror films, yes, even. The more recent ones, Drag Me to Hell, it's still held together by themes. Going back to Hellraiser, it was Clive Barker who, you know, suggested that I get simple. Come up with something that's simple, Chris, that people can whistle. And so that prompted the main theme. I might not have gone down that road had he not insisted. But times have changed. Sound design cues, I mean, sound design scores that are integrated into the sound texture of the entire picture in
right.
a sort of indistinguishable way is very popular now. And I think that's one of the things that excites me about this new score of mine. You're going to be hard pressed to find the melody in it. That was the big thing for me, was to let go of that. You know, my natural inclination to want to have melody holding even a horror film together.
Mm.
I sure wish in my own work that I found something as simple as the Jaws motive. That's the one thing that's missing in my lust for having even my most horrific horror score held together by tunes that are over 8 bars long. I think hurt me in many ways.
Well, I got to tell you, I never once listened to any of your scores and think, too bad this doesn't sound like Jaws. I mean, your
scores
are
incredible. No, I want it to sound like Jaws. But
yeah.
The bottom line is, you walk to anyone on the street, and you tap them on the shoulders. Before, you don't tap them on the shoulders. Walk behind them and go, da-dum, da-dum. They'll know immediately what it is. They'll go, fuck, the shark.
you know what I'm saying? Yeah.
Number one, you go up to them behind their back and go. They'll know. Psycho. It's a simple gesture. It's so simple.
Yeah.
I don't want to come up with a Jaws ripoff. I'm just saying I wish I'd come up with something as simple as that that was so distinguished. That you could go up to someone on the street and just in 2 seconds have communicated something to them that they immediately know what it means and it scares the shit out of them.
Well, I think that, and this goes to your electronic work in the latest film, Sinister. I mean, the primary motivation for you has to be to create music that first and foremost serves the film.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
Have you seen it?
I haven't been able to see Sinister yet. No, sir. No, sir.
Okay, so you have not seen it. Have you heard any of the music yet?
I've heard a bit of it. Yes, sir.
Oh, you've heard some of it. Have you heard? Okay. So I'm wondering, see, it's interesting that, you know, I'm wondering what you've heard, because there's what I did for the CD, you see, is I modified a lot of the music that I wrote for the movie. I took the score for the movie, and then I modified it for the CD. So
okay.
I'm wondering if you're probably hearing the CD tracks.
I probably am. Yes, sir.
Yeah. Which is different. I mean, if you see the film, the score that I did works really well. But at the end of the day, if you take it away, if you withdraw it, you remove it from the picture, it is very sound design-like, you
mm-hmm.
know? It's they're dense clusters that work well to create this non-melodic, sonic sickness, you know, that helps make the picture more diseased. But I think removed from the picture, it's hard to listen to completely on its own because it's not being prompted by normal musical procedures. You know, if it's not melodic, what is it? Because the nice thing about melody is it immediately assists the music in having a logic that everyone will understand. A bunch of low pulses and clusters and smashes and screams don't register to a
mm-hmm.
listener as something that's easy listening, you know, removed from the picture. Does that make sense?
I know exactly what you're saying, yes.
We've heard a lot of these soundtracks from horror movies that are sort of in the synth sound world. It's hard to get, let's face it, it's hard to get through them, you know?
Right. I find that because I collect film scores, and I mean, I find that with some that they're a different experience when you listen to them on CD than when you see them in the film.
Right.
And that speaks to what you're saying. But you've created some of the most beautifully melodic themes, and one of my favorites is actually Jennifer 8.
Oh,
oh my gosh, that opening theme alone is on repeat. tell me about that project and that particular score.
Okay.
What was that?
That score was a breakthrough score for me. You know, that was the first chance I got at scoring a major studio movie. Though it wasn't my first movie, I'd have to look at my credits. I've probably done like these 20 movies already.
Mm-hmm.
But they all been low budget things, you know, New World Pictures, Canon Films, you know, these kind of low budget things, Roger Corman movies, New Line Films, nothing major. And actually, I've done a Fox movie. I've done a Fox movie before The Fly 2. But even though I was the director's first choice on that movie, the studio just wouldn't have me because I didn't have enough legitimate credits to make me seem like I could actually do a major movie for this major movie company, Paramount. And listen, I'm not stupid. I get it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's, you know, I'm the guy who does the B movies. Can he do an A movie? You know, if all he's done is B movies, we don't know if he can do an A movie. I get the logic. But what happened was the guy that they hired instead to do the score was an A player, delivered something that no one liked. The director certainly didn't like it, but as well the studio realized that this was not going to work for this movie. And this is a big name guy. And, you know, I felt sorry that he got his, everyone, you know, no one wishes to see someone get their score thrown out. But having said that, I thank my lucky stars he did, you know, because that opened up the door for me being called in.
Yeah.
You know, like the director, Bruce Robinson, was able to turn to the studio people and say, listen, okay, man, we just blew our wad on this big superstar guy. I knew he wasn't the right guy for the movie to begin with, and that didn't make it easy for that composer, I'm sure. You know, please, can we hire the guy that I wanted to get with, the first time around? We don't have the money to get another heavyweight. What do we got to lose, you know? So they got me on board, and I was scared shitless. I didn't have much time. Bruce reminds me, because I worked with him recently on The Rum Diary, the Johnny Depp movie.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the first time he'd done a movie since Jennifer 8, because he had such a bad experience on that. But he reminded me when I saw him on Rum Diary that he said, Chris, you got that score done in no time at all. I said, how much time did I? You know, you had about 3 weeks at the most before you started recording that. And I do remember the first theme I came up with that was supposed to be that main theme for the movie. This is before you did synth mock-ups. And so I did like a piano recording or something. And I remember bringing the piano demo over to the dub stage. I thought I was just going to see him alone. But they had me put the cassette on the dub stage where they were doing a temp dub. They stopped the dub, and the room was packed with people, and they put my little cassette up for the main theme, and it just didn't go over. You could hear dead silence in the room, and I thought, I'm fucked. This is the end of it, you know. So he came up to me. He was kind. He said, you know, we got a problem here, okay? And he described to me what he was looking for. I said, I think I can get this, Bruce. Okay, I'm really sorry. I remember driving back home. I was living in a tiny little apartment right off the 405 freeway in Santa Monica Boulevard, right by the New Art Movie Theater. It was called the Rat Hole, affectionately, a tiny little place. And I was driving down Santa Monica Boulevard, and I was right at the intersection of Santa Monica Boulevard and Wilshire, right by the park there where the fountain is. Mm-hmm. And boom, that idea came into my head. And
wow.
You know, thank the Lord I have a cassette machine, because by the time I got back to West L.A., I pretty much worked the theme out in my head. and I went to the piano, worked, you know, got it down under my fingers, called up Bruce, played it to him over the phone. He said, that's my movie. That's it.
Maybe I'm completely off on this, but I think what you just said speaks to this. It's very mysterious where ideas come from when lightning strikes you. I mean, you kind of have to be open to channeling it. Do you find that your best work occurs to you like that, and the work that is less resonant are the pieces that you really have to try hard at?
That's a good question. You know, I'm not going to say my best work comes in those moments. I can tell you that I have had a lot of my first attempts thrown out. Luckily, I wasn't thrown out with that first attempt.
Mm-hmm.
My second attempt or my third attempt, as it turns out, is not only closer to what the director needs, was originally envisioning for the movie, so I was getting closer into the side of his head and to what he thought was appropriate. But as it turns out, he's right. It is the right score for the movie. And when I go back and I look at my earlier ideas, I go, what the hell was I really thinking? You know, it depends.
Yeah.
It depends. It depends upon the picture and the director. Sometimes you align yourself with the film and your first go-round, you get it right on the spot. Sometimes that can happen because you're in a state of panic right from the get-go. There's no time to screw up, and maybe the anxiety issue helps get you on the right path a lot quicker than if you know. As they say, I'm often asked the question, Jesus, film composers, man, you guys write really quickly. How much time do you get to write a score? And I usually go, as much or as little time as they give you. And they go, oh, come on. It's true. You know, I've been on films where, like Jennifer 8, I was called to replace the score, and I was given 3 weeks, and I probably had 52 minutes of music to write. And I did it.
Mm.
If I'd been given 8 weeks, if I'd been given 18 weeks, who knows what the score would have come out like.
Right.
But it was the pressure. And interestingly, no matter how many days or weeks you're given, you're always working right up to the last minute, and you will say as you walk onto the scoring stage, if I'd had 1 minute less, I wouldn't have gotten the score done in time. It's because you're subconsciously, your mind, your clock, and your productive clock will like attune to that delivery date, and it seems to figure out how to get you to the finish line so that it will appear as if you'd had one last minute, you never would have gotten it done, but yet the internal clock worked it out the minute you did your homework and realized how many days you had to get the job done. Does that make sense?
That absolutely makes sense. I mean, I hear it with some of the independent filmmakers I speak with, and their kind of time restrictions bring out a certain kind of spontaneity in their creative process that might not have been there otherwise.
So, in the case of Jennifer 8, a short time schedule on a misfire got me on course. In the case of Hellraiser, the first idea I submitted to him, he thought that I was missing the point of the movie or was too complicated for its own good. He said just those right handful of words, he knew exactly how to direct me, and it put me right on course. Even you're talking about, I remember my first session with Sam Raimi on Spider-Man 3 was the birth of Sandman, that scene in Spider-Man 3. Mm-hmm. And I'd already worked with the guy before, and look what they had. They had even had my own music tent in that scene from Hellraiser or something like Hellbound. And you'd think I would have been able to knock that one out of the ballpark, but my first show and tell with Sam on that movie, the first scene he saw was the birth of the Sandman cue. And I played it for him, and he turned to me and said, "Fascinating. Nope, that's not it." basically. I mean, in his own, sweet way. He said, "Oh, really?" And he always says, "Oh, great work, maestro. And oh, I like, it's so good. I really like it. But, this way, I like this one, but this is what's not right." And then he'll, I was like, "Oh, shit." but then, interesting, that's the cue that I got it right the second time or the third time. Maybe it was the third time. But I keep on hearing, "Oh, Chris, that's the best cue in the movie." And I go, "Really? Yeah, not my favorite cue." But they go, "Oh, yeah, that's the best cue in the movie." Okay, it's unexpected. Okay, well, I'll give you, And that was Sam's thing. He guided me. The directors know, they really do know. They don't know in musical terms, but they know in dramatic terms. And you have to keep yourself open to try to get inside their minds.
Yes.
There's nothing that makes me happier than for a director to turn to me at the end of delivering the music and say, "Man, totally what I was expecting, totally what I think is right for this movie. You were so in tune with my thoughts."
One question I had has to do with, everyone on that works on a film, they are in essence an assistant storyteller. When you're working on a project, I would think that it would be essential that you connect emotionally with it in some respect. Have you ever run into a problem where you haven't found that connection?
Never. Thank the freaking Lord. Never once. When I come on board a movie, I don't know why it is. I connect with it. I do. And I become a believer. I am a fan, a true fan of that movie while I'm working on it. I think it's in my heart. I'll really go, this is the best horror film, if it's a horror film, I've ever seen. And I will defend the director when he's going through his issues with the studio or the test screened audience not buying his vision.
Mm-hmm.
I feel his pain. I don't want to sound too much like Clinton, but I do. I become a partner, for that period of time. And because of my faith in him and my excitement of being on board, I find something in the film that I can connect with. It may be a character. It may be the channel. It may be a character. It may be, like I said, a moment in the movie which is so bizarre, if we're talking about horror films, that's so bizarre. I go, there's something here that's inexplicable that only music could capture, and that becomes an exciting part of the score. Or, you know, I look at the film and go, what can I do to challenge myself here?
Right.
Even if I'm not totally connecting with a movie, I set up some kind of a challenge, an obstacle. And in these days, it's usually the budget. You know, you got no budget. What can you do with a small ensemble? So that's always fun. Is how can you make something work with restricted means? You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't recall a single movie where I've said I have no ideas. There's plenty of movies I've worked on where I've said my ideas stink, but it's not that I've run out of ideas.
Yeah. Well, you've done a lot of different genres. I mean, I'm thinking of kind of the jazzier sound of a Rounders,
sure.
Or you know, I love your score for Love Happens too, which I personally think is an underrated movie.
Isn't that a great movie?
I loved the movie. The movie had such kind of emotional resonance to me, and I thought, how did people miss this? But the kind of score that I wanted to ask you about finally is
okay.
Those in Service of a Comedy. Is that the most difficult, challenging genre to score?
You know what? Comedy is definitely a challenge for me. There's nothing I can't do, quite frankly, and I do believe that. In fact, I've not had enough opportunities to work on comedy films where I feel like I can talk about this with the same kind of experience and knowledge through experience that I'm able to talk about horror films, thrillers, action films, science fiction, fantasy films. That's my world. Comedy I've done, you know, between actual, you know, flat out comedies, romantic comedies, black comedies, not many, maybe 8 at the most. They're very hard. They're very, very hard to do successfully. Of course, needless to say, any score that tries to be funny is in desperate trouble, you know.
Right.
For the most part, the scores have to play the role of the straight man. But at the same time, do it in such a way that it's a straight man with a very flamboyant, wearing a very flamboyant tie, you know, something along those lines. You can't be bland. It's just you can't be overtly funny. You have to find a language which may be offsetting to the subject matter unexpected. I guess that's not offsetting is the wrong word. A non sequitur, something that you would not expect. It's the juxtaposition of a certain type of language against the picture, which all of a sudden brings a new slant to it. You know, it's finding the language. I would have to say finding the appropriate language that will make that film special and funnier in a subtle way.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but hopefully I recall it correctly. I think I remember your score for The Man Who Knew Too Little.
Right.
Thank you. It's kind of a big Henry Mancini-esque orchestra.
Yeah, that totally was my mission. On that film, I'll tell you what happened. That was John A. Neill, a director with whom I worked more than any other director. I had done. He hired me to do Copycat when another prominent composer walked out at the last minute. Thank the Lord, again, another walkout. And I did Copycat, which was more up my alley in an obvious way. And after I completed that, he turned to me and said, my next movie is going to be a comedy film, and I'd like to help you to do that. And I was like, I sort of bit my lip and said, is he serious? I don't have a track record of comedies, but hey, fine, you know, I'm thrilled. And so I love that movie, The Man Who Knew Too Little. And I had some ideas for it that were not what you hear. And I remember going, you know, going to the producer and to John and said, I've got these ideas. I want to do them. They go, fine. Oh, yeah, that sounds good. But tell me something. You ever heard the Pink Panther? I said, well, of course I've heard the Pink Panther. Well, listen to it again, Richard. You know, okay. Yeah, and then I go back and go, well, I was in Pink Panther, but you know what, I'd love to try to do this and this and this. And they go, oh, that's fascinating, but the Pink Panther, can you give us the Pink Panther? I said, because they had tempted, and they'd tempt some of the Pink Panther in it. I said, well, yeah, I can do that. And they said, we think that's what the score should be like, sort of have this Pink Panther attitude, but with orchestra. So it's big band and orchestra. I love the score, and I think it works great, you know, does what the film needs. However, and then I'll shut up, I remember at the premiere party, I think this is the only time in which a star on the movie has sort of been slightly non-receptive to me being introduced to him. In this case, it was Bill Murray. I think he liked the score so much. I may be wrong on that. You know, even he said, "Oh yeah, that Pink Panther thing or something." I don't know exactly what his words were, but he didn't seem too thrilled with the music, as I recall.
Well, I loved it, and I love everything you do. And this has been such a great pleasure for me to finally have an opportunity to speak to you. Please, let's do this again sometime.
You know, I love doing this. I'm thrilled that you wanted to include me. I'm, like, totally psyched out of my mind that you actually know the music and you're a big fan.